Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin. And this is the second part of our discussion about the year 1980, the biggest year of change for the Beatles. And when we left, we'd only gotten to April. Paul McCartney has put out his coming up single. It's hit the radar of John Lennon. John Lennon's also listening to lots of other music at the time. And at the end of April, John starts writing. He'd been doing bits and pieces.
I mean, there is this myth that he subsequently propounded that really he just put his guitar down in 1975, 1976 and had done nothing. Mm. But he's kind of fiddling around with bits of songs. But within sort of a week of hearing Coming Up, he demos the song Dear Yoko, which will appear on Double Fantasy. And the thing that I think is amusing is the following day, Yoko instructs him to observe a 10-day silence for the purposes of clearing out his head. So I think, you know, I've written you this song, darling, Dear Yoko. Very nice. You could just shut up for 10 days. So an interesting...
Keep it to yourself. But it starts to unlock John's creativity and actually...
Yeah.
It's the trickle that eventually leads to a big flood.
I think so. And, Yoko is very into... to numerology and, all of these sort of... She's tarot readers, yes, and things like this. So one of the things that she does from time to time is tell John to go and travel to a certain direction. You have to go around the world in a particular direction. So in May and June.
Yeah, after his 10-day silence.
After his 10-day silence, she then sends him off traveling, and he visits South Africa and Spain and Germany.
Yeah, I didn't know he was in Germany.
I hadn't realized he got that close to coming back to the UK.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that he was in Europe in 1980. But the other big deal,
the big deal in May
1980, the thing that caused the Buntings to be raised high on streets up and down the land, was the release of McCartney 2, which eventually comes out, and it hits number one in the UK, number three in the USA, and it's on the back, as we said, of this very big, successful coming up single. I think it's fair to say that people might have raised an eyebrow when they heard the rest of the album.
Yes. And not similar to the Wings output.
Yeah, well, it's not similar at all. And I have to admit, it's an album, when I first heard it in 89, I thought it was terrible. And it took me a number of years to actually unlock it. I now think it's a fantastic record. It's the sound of Paul just kind of tipping his head onto tape and seeing what comes out, more or less. You know, it's very unguarded, but it doesn't really get unanimously praised to any degree.
No, I mean, it is. I have to say, it is an album that I like. It gets better with time. Mm. When I bought it as it came out, I think on CD. Maybe I got it on CD, which might have been a little bit...
Well, CD
later.
Wasn't 1980.
No, so maybe it wasn't until it came out on CD.
Yeah.
But I do remember the first time I heard it all the way through, like, not liking it.
Yeah.
And thinking, this is very odd.
Mm.
I suspect where I first heard it was, there was a Radio 1 show, and this is just coming to me as I'm talking to you. Maybe Tommy Vance interviewing Paul McCartney and going through every single track
on the album, yeah,
and sort of playing every single track with commentary.
Yes.
Because I do seem to remember him having difficulty with bogey music, actually saying anything that was in any way, how do you talk about that track? That's just a kind of jokey, throwaway, weird track. But clearly it was sufficiently, the McCartney publicity machine was in full gear here, where he's appearing on the radio and he's talking about the album.
And in the grand tradition of, you know, Red Rose Speedway, there is a double album version of McCartney 2. That was the original plan. And I think the thing that really locked the album in for me was when the special edition came out in 2012, where you get all the tracks recorded from the McCartney 2 sessions. And you get to see the kind of the breadth of what he was doing experimentally at the time. Because I think the detail or the joy is in some of the B-sides, like
Check My Machine. That's on the CD issue.
Secret Friend.
Yeah.
And Secret Friend, which is the longest Paul McCartney song. It's a 10-minute kind of trancey, ambient-y, slinky instrumental. You know, I think it's really interesting to see him work in that form.
It's funny because I wonder, again, did he have a sort of crisis of confidence before the album came out? Mm. Because, you know, people talk about, oh, this is very kind of experimental. It's very forward thinking. It's got all of these keyboard tracks. And, you know, he was really ahead of the curve here. But actually, when you listen to the album, half the album isn't like that.
It's quite traditional.
It's quite traditional. Mm. You know, you've got Waterfalls and One of These Days and things like Bogey Music, which is just a bit of a kind of a
laugh,
joke, bit of a laugh. But was he actually originally intending to put out something that was almost entirely keyboards? And
well, you know, whenever Paul does that kind of thing, you know, and he'd done it with McCartney and he'd done it with Wings Wildlife and then he did McCartney 2, nobody thanks him for it. And he gets really bad reviews and he gets quite defensive and he retreats into kind of a more popular type of form. And I think later on with Fireman, he manages to match those two worlds.
Is that because he's sort of distancing himself slightly? It's not under the McCartney brand.
Yes, he can say this is a different thing.
The point we were talking before about the McGear album, that he kind of cuts loose a little bit. And, you know, my theory is that the McGear album is the missing link between Red Rose Speedway and McCartney 2. Well, that it's a kind of halfway house. And McCartney is doing odd, slightly atonal things on the McGear album that he just wouldn't get away with, or wouldn't perhaps have the nerve or the confidence to put out under his own name.
Well, the McGear album, if anyone listening is unfamiliar with it, has just been re-released as a, you know, a three-disc reissue. It's only about £15, and it's a sensational reissue. It's a brilliant album, and it's Paul and Wings with his brother Mike singing.
Yeah, absolutely an essential album. It's an album that I always liked, but this little clamshell box that they have with it is just sensational. I can't recommend
it's
that.
It's a super box and it's a super album and it's well worth digging out. But yeah, there is stuff on McCartney 2 that I think stands well. Dark Room is a track I love. I think it sounds like Gorillaz.
Yeah.
This track, Temporary Secretary, where the synthesizers, you know, Paul thinks they sound like typewriters, so he writes a song about secretaries. Again, Hot Chip, kind of in later years, rehabilitated this song, and Paul, who loves a bit of attention, brought the song back into his set lists, you know, to try and explain that this was, you know, for the diehards, it was a great moment. For the rest of the audience, it not so much, maybe. Did you ever see him do
But I would love to hear him do that. You know, it's when he pulls those kind of odd things into the set list. That's that's what I want to hear.
Yeah. And so when McCartney 2 comes out, Paul is interviewed in Cannes at the time, and he sort of says, Lennon and McCartney, that's not a thing.
Yeah. So Seaside Woman, which is a Red Rose Speedway
era track.
Era track. There's a little animated film, and that actually wins Palme d'Or for best short film. So McCartney's there. He said, no, when Lennon McCartney, he's specifically talking about the songwriting partnership. And he said, when I last spoke to John, he'd said he'd finished with songwriting. And that the last time.
So he doesn't know what's about to happen.
He doesn't know what's about to happen. That was 1976. He's referring back to a conversation from 4 years earlier.
And on the day McCartney 2 comes out in the US, John, there's a story about John that gets into the papers.
Oh, yes. This is so a week later, 21st of May, McCartney 2 is released in the US. And John announces his intention to sell his quarter share in Apple.
Which he doesn't do.
This is a sort of serious announcement. And is it just a coincidence that on the day that McCartney's album is being released, Lennon is trying to steal the thunder a little bit?
I'm sure it is. Who would be so petty in the world of rock and roll?
It's just a coincidence.
On the 19th of May, Ringo and Barbara who are very much an item at this point, they have a car accident where the car crashes into two lampposts and flips onto its roof. Yeah. Ringo pulls Barbara from the car, and they are very lucky yes. with an accident like yeah. that. You know that.
This is half a mile from where Mark Bolan was killed.
Really?
So very close to that spot. And I think the story is that Ringo pulls Barbara from the car
yeah.
and then nonchalantly goes back to the car to retrieve his cigarettes. So you've got to keep up.
Was he driving back to Tittenhurst Park? Possibly?
Don't know.
Okay, where he was living at the time. But then we get to June. And on the morning of the 5th of June 1980, John Lennon, along with Captain Hank Halstead, the Tyler Connolly and cousins, Ellen and Kevin Connolly, they leave Newport for Bermuda on a boat, boat holiday. So John, continuing his trek around the world and doing yeah. different things, sets off on a boat with a plan to sail to Bermuda. And in the midst of all of this, it goes wrong.
Yeah.
So what happens?
Well, there's a storm. There's a really bad storm, and one by one, the members of the crew start to get sick. They're no longer capable, and ultimately Lennon is left on his own to sort of handle this boat. Now, I always find this story slightly unbelievable. That I thought, so suddenly this millionaire rock star who is on a boat with a crew,
yes,
everybody else is incapacitated. So in the manner of sort of Airplane or, you know, he is there a pilot, he just steps up. And I thought, how could he possibly do this?
But yeah.
the backstory is that he has been learning to sail.
Right.
So in the preceding months, he's been taking sailing lessons. So this is not just he suddenly discovers that he knows how to handle a boat. He has been taking lessons. He and Yoko have bought a yacht, which is called the Royal Isis, which I think reflects Yoko's love of all things Egyptian and bang, but it's very close to the name of the boat, the Royal Iris, is the boat
that the Beatles played on
yeah. Back in Liverpool. So he has actually been learning to sail.
And the legend of the story is that he's left on his own and he's sailing into this massive storm. Yeah. He's got his hands on the wheel and he's never felt more alive. You know, Yoko's back in New York with Sean. Nobody else can take the ship. And he sort of has this revelation or transformation. His father had been on the seas before him, traveling the world, and now he's left to fend for himself. And
it's like a bad movie.
It is like a bad movie. But, you know, you kind of hear these stories of people who have car crashes or some kind of things that kind of, you could say, you know, is he woken up from something? Does something get stirred inside him? But I think he realizes that he's, whatever comfort he's been living in the last couple of years, that actually there's something else to life.
This is the thing that kind of jolts him out of that.
Yeah.
And that the whole house husband period, sort of 76 to 75, 76 through 1980, it's difficult to know just what the correct version of that is. You know, he would have it, he had it very much in 1980. He's giving interviews saying it was all about baking bread and looking after the children and it was at the child, and it was marvelous and it was very domestic and he was having a great time. His personal assistant would be saying, no, he was depressed, he was reclusive, he was not in a good space mentally, that his marriage was in difficulties. You know, you have the Albert Goldman book where he's drawing very direct comparisons with the sort of Elvis decline and the drug use. And so there's a lot kind of going on and a lot of mystery, if you like. That whole sort of 3-4 year period is shrouded. But this genuinely does seem to be something that jolts him out of that.
You know, it's funny how he's labelled a house husband. I mean, Yoko wasn't putting out albums at this time, and she doesn't get labelled anything. You know, nobody's kind of saying,
That's the sexist 70s for you.
Well, yes. And we're still sometimes doesn't feel like we're much further along. Maybe we are. But the reality is that John arrives in Bermuda on the 11th of June. And over the next 3 weeks, he essentially writes all the songs that will appear on the Double Fantasy album and the subsequent Milk and Honey album. And there was an app that came out a few years ago called the Bermuda Tapes, where you could hear John's demos of Woman, Starting Over, I'm Losing You, Nobody Told Me, Dear Yoko. You know, these are
I remember
all winning songs.
I checked, but that app is no longer
available. Gone, is it?
I couldn't find it. But if anyone out there has access to the app, but I couldn't come across. I remember it at the time.
So it seems that a lot of these were written quite quickly. Now, maybe there were some fragments hanging around before Bermuda. Maybe he was tying in some loose ends, or he was codifying or putting things down that he'd been thinking of. But there's certainly, when you look at that body of songs and the subsequent album, there certainly is a theme of restarting. Here's where I am now. Yes. Here's what's going on.
I think so. He's taking the little scraps, bits and pieces that he's been working on over the previous few years. He's pulling those together, and they're suddenly emerging as finished songs. So you've got Watching the Wheels, for example, which is really clearly a direct commentary on his absence from the music industry. Mm. So he's got a villa in Bermuda that has a piano. He gets a sort of beatbox.
The villa Undercliff near Hamilton in Bermuda.
A sort of boombox thing that he can record on, and he's just pumping out these demos. The other thing that happens is he goes to a club and he hears the B-52s.
Rock Lobster.
Rock Lobsters. That's the first time he's heard that, and he hears this and he thinks, it's Yoko.
Yeah, that ululation at the end is a Yoko sound, and it's another song that hits his antenna. And I think it kind of adds to this thing that he's going in the right direction by stepping back into music.
And he's on the phone to Yoko saying, it's time.
Yes.
The world has caught up, you know, and your material that sort of over the last 10 years that people were sort of saying was too out there and too, it's now coming into the mainstream. So he very clearly, so Yoko flies to Bermuda.
Yep.
Stays for 2 days.
Yep.
Because she can't stand the heat. Gets back on a plane and flies back to New York. And this is a big bust up.
Right.
Because Lennon is really angry that she's flying back. So that's when he writes the song, I'm Losing You.
Right.
And that whole, you know, here I am in some stranger's room. That specifically comes out of this kind of argument where she flies back to New York.
And he demos all this material between the 21st and the 30th of June 1980. And one of the reasons we're talking about 1980 is just how quick it all happens. You know, at the start of June, he's got nothing.
Yeah.
At the end of June, he's written two albums worth of material, essentially. And things then move pretty fast, but not without the other big event of June 1980, which was the release of Waterfalls as the second single from the McCartney album.
Yes.
I find it interesting.
It's comparable. It's directly comparable.
It is interesting that Waterfalls was a hit. It was a top 10 hit, and I don't think it's remembered at all. It's a song that's kind of disappeared from the McCartney radar completely. And it's a charming song, and it's got very melodic, and it's got a really interesting kind of video for it with a real polar bear.
I was going to say we could do without the polar bear line, but
the jumper.
It's a great...
His hair is parted in the other side. Lots of interesting things. But it's a song that I've never heard it on the radio. I've never heard it. It doesn't appear in any greatest hits, and yet it's a top 10. But at the end of June, then John has all these songs in his back pocket, and so the notion is that he's going to start wanting to record them. Moving into July, at the start of July, George publishes I, Me, Mine.
Yes,
and that's not like a regular book.
No, this is a book that's recently been, within the past couple of years, has been reissued in an expanded version. But essentially, John referred to this as George's autobiography, but it's not really an autobiography. It's a replica of handwritten lyrics, and then there's little kind of comments about where the song was written or things that... It's a very slight book. He's worked on this with Derek Taylor. It's a limited edition of... 2,000 copies, and it retails for £148. Yeah. Now, I mean, that's a lot of money. I remember, you'll not be surprised to know, that in July 1980, I was a member of the George Harrison fan club.
Really?
And
Colour me surprised.
We were being asked, the fan club asked people to send in money so that the fan club
could buy a copy.
And that was the point where I thought, well, do you think George would give a copy
to his
fan club?
Do you know how much a copy sells for now if you want to buy one?
I don't.
Okay.
I do not know.
Have a look on eBay afterwards.
With several thousand pounds, I would imagine.
I'd imagine so. Because they're signed, aren't they?
They are signed.
Yeah.
But anyway, the key thing here is John reads this book.
Yes.
Now, I don't know whether he bought a copy or whether George sent him a copy, but he reads this book and he is extremely annoyed that he's not mentioned enough in the book. And he makes a comment to say, you know, he remembers every, George remembers every two-bit saxophone player that he worked with, but really I'm not in the book at all. My influence is zero, yeah, according to this. And he holds forth at great length. And this is something he returns to time and time again. Over the next 6 months, he's giving interviews about this. I've read that book.
Yeah.
John is not mentioned any more or less than Paul,
yeah,
or Ringo. Yeah. It's not that type of book.
Yeah.
It's a book about, here are the songs. This is what this song means to me. Here's the lyric. This is what it's about. You know, I was in Eric Clapton's garden when I wrote Here Comes the Sun. That type of thing. It's not a detailed autobiographical,
yeah, here's all
work.
The,
yeah,
corners of my life.
Yeah. So my own feeling is it's a bit of an overreaction.
Yeah, but it's interesting that John cares enough to,
yes, that's,
want the,
that's probably the most telling thing.
Yeah, to want the acclaim.
Yeah.
In the middle of July, Paul, Linda, and Lawrence Juber from Wings go to attend a session for Ringo's next studio album. They record Private Property, and what's the other song?
Attention.
Attention, okay. Private Property ends up getting this big, laborious video.
It is, there's a, that's worth
the
checking out.
Which is a very strange
it's very
thing.
Old.
Paul is in it, and
yeah, it's worth checking out. Not Paul's greatest songs, perhaps, but, you know, entertaining enough.
Well, yes, but it's still an avenue of communication between Paul and Ringo. Ringo still remains the one that everyone will communicate with.
Yes, this is the thing. Ringo is gearing up. You know, we heard in the last episode, you know, John had already given him a couple of demos of songs that he thought,
yeah,
might be good. So, again, this is Ringo after that period of commercial failure. He's clearly revisiting the formula from the Ringo album in,
yeah,
1973. Goodnight Vienna, where he is getting soliciting contributions from the other,
yeah,
other members of the band.
And then at the end of July 1980, something that I only discovered when I was kind of researching for this episode was that Ringo and Barbara appear on a syndicated talk show in the US called The John Davidson Show, which, like all things these days, is now available on YouTube. Mm. And Ringo is very, very drunk. And It's you know, as I said, you can look at it and say, oh, he's a Jack the Lad, or you can, yeah, look at it and say, this is very sad and very worrying. And I'm sure if Ringo saw it himself these days, he would find it a deeply troubling watch, because the guy, even at the start of the show, the host is trying to introduce Ringo, and Ringo just walks on in the middle of the introduction,
yeah,
thinking he's been introduced, and then proceeds to start take pictures with his camera and kind of swing around, and he's gone.
It is not comfortable watching. It would remind you of those Oliver Reed,
yes,
appearances,
yeah, yeah,
where,
yeah,
you know, he thinks he's being funny.
Yeah.
The audience think he's being funny for a little while.
And then that changes.
And then it starts to change, and the host is annoyed, and,
yeah,
you know, it's just a bit of a car crash.
And he's slurring, and he's taking the questions off the host, and the host is kind of walking off, and it's you know, he says, you know, he was just backstage drinking cognac the whole time.
It is. I mean, it's you know, it's completely indicative of where he was in 1980.
And then at the very end of July, the 31st of July, Yoko calls Jack Douglas and asks him if he will listen to John's acoustic demos and put together a band and try and produce,
yeah,
a record.
And this is where it suddenly everything starts to accelerate.
Yes.
So when you look at the timeline, 31st of July, Yoko makes that call. The demos are sent to Douglas in a kind of sealed envelope, you know, kind of for your eyes only thing. He listens to them. He thinks they're incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, he will say, you know, that they had the magic about them, and why?
Well, you know, we're used to those songs now, but if you were getting a tape of,
yeah,
with Woman and Starting Over, and it's John Lennon's voice, and you haven't heard it,
yeah,
in 5 years, you'd be like, oh my God.
And he's playing them on an acoustic guitar or a piano, or he's got a little drum machine going in the background.
Yeah.
So he assembles the band. The story is, at one point, having rehearsed the band, not telling the band,
yeah,
who they will be working with,
yeah,
he then says, oh, you know, I want you all to meet, you know, in this particular location, and then we're going to go on to another location.
Yes.
And it's only when the band pull up outside the Dakota,
yes,
that they suddenly realize
what's happening.
And they do little sort of rehearsals and things in the Dakota. But then 4 days later, 4th of August, Lennon's back in a studio.
Yeah.
So it's that quick.
It's so quick.
It's incredibly quick.
Yeah, so she calls him at the end of July. They're in the studio the first week in August with that band. I'm trying to think who's in that band. Tony Levin is there, I know, on bass.
Tony Levin, Hugh McCracken. Is Earl Slick in that band?
He could be. I've got a copy of Double Fantasy in front
so
of me.
So some of these are effectively Andy New York,
yeah,
the drummer. These are effectively New York's top session players.
Yeah.
And some of these people have worked with Lennon before, all the way back to sort of Mind Games era.
Yeah, Andy Newmark, Tony Levin, Earl Slick, you're right, Hugh McCracken, all these people, Ed Walsh on Oberheim, John and Yoko, obviously. And when do Cheap Trick make an appearance?
They come in later. Yeah. Douglas brings Cheap Trick in, and we talk about that briefly. That, to me, is the great lost opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, Cheap Trick are huge Beatles fans.
Yes.
I mean, huge aficionados.
And they're a tight band. Sympathetic to pop rock.
Yeah. And I think at this stage, I think I'm right in saying they are currently working with George Martin.
Okay.
At this period, when Douglas gets them to come in and they record a couple of tracks, one of which is I'm Losing You.
Yes.
Which finally made an appearance on the Lennon anthology. And there's an excellent little video that they did after the fact, where the two guys from Cheap Trick and Tony Levin, and there's little animated drawings that Lennon had done. Fantastic version.
It is very good. I'll put a link up to that.
All I can think of is what would Double Fantasy have sounded like if they had just gone with Cheap Trick as the backing band.
If it had been a John and Cheap Trick album or even a John and Cheap Trick tour, holy moly.
Yeah, it's the John and Cheap Trick tour, I think, is the thing. But fan as I am of Yoko,
yes,
she is the one that said no.
Yeah,
it's the wrong sound. It's not we don't want a rock sound. We want a pop sound. We're going for a kind of commercial pop. And then she doesn't seem to have realized that Cheap Trick were a pretty big name.
Yeah,
and she started saying, "Well, why would this band get a free ride on John's coattails?" So Cheap Trick are not. They don't pass the audition.
So they're spending August in the studio. On the 13th of August, a certain somebody calls the studio.
Yes.
Who's
Paul.
That? Paul McCartney.
Paul McCartney
right.
calls the studio. So word has got out
yes.
that John is back in the studio. So Paul calls the studio to speak to John, ostensibly about a collaboration. So the story is that McCartney hears that John is back and thinks, right, what can we do? Yoko does not allow the call to be put through. So
she doesn't make it easy sometimes.
Well,
I know,
you know, so I suppose charitably she's thinking, you know,
we've got to do this bit first.
We've got to get John back.
It's
John and Yoko. It's John Lennon. We don't want this to turn into a Beatles reunion or to get this, but you can imagine the sense of excitement on the part of Paul.
Yeah.
Where, you know, as recently as a month before, he's giving an interview in Cannes saying,
John's gone.
He's retired. Yeah. That's it. And he holds forth to that. He said, you know, we all work and then we get to a point where we've got enough money to do the things we want to do and then we retire, and he's retired and that's it. And it's never going to happen again. And then suddenly, you know, a month or 2 months later, the word is out. Lennon's back. He's in a studio. He's recording an album. So of course, there's this. Suddenly, Paul sees his writing partner is
and just
there.
Wants to see what's up.
Yeah.
And so they're working in the studio in August. There's a video shoot one day where they do some rock and roll stuff.
This for me is the great lost.
Is it lost? Or is it just
artifact?
Being hidden from us?
It's not being seen.
Okay.
So
because there are lots of videotape bootlegs of things from the studio that I've seen. There's Lennon interviews. There's Lennon singing with that crazy double
guitar thing
that he has, and you know,
there's dozens and dozens of photographs. There's little snippets.
Yeah,
there's the promo stuff they took walking through the park.
There's video camera footage of Julian's birthday.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there is some footage, but this was a specific.
Sean's birthday. Probably.
Sean's birthday. There's a specific video shoot set up.
Yeah.
For this day. And it sort of runs the entire day. So the studio band are playing Come On Everybody, Rip It Up, I'm a Man, I'm Losing You, Just Like Starting Over. And interestingly, She's a Woman.
Wow.
Which is a Paul song.
Yeah.
This is shot across the entire day.
Yeah.
Professionally recorded. John sees it.
Yeah.
Doesn't like it. Doesn't like the way he looks. Vetoes it. And as far as I'm aware, that has never surfaced, so I don't know whether it was wiped
or not,
or it's sitting in a vault somewhere. But it seems to me that you know, enough time has passed that this is one of those sort of little things that's sitting out there somewhere. That
a John Lennon 1980 box set or a John and Yoko 1980 box set could be an amazing thing if all this stuff is still around.
Clearly, there's a lot of run-throughs, a lot of studio material. There's a lot of demos because bits of it have surfaced on Anthology, the a few bonus tracks on the Double Fantasy and Milk and Honey reissues, the acoustic compilation. The stuff is there. So it seems to me that a 1980 box is just waiting to be... And I'd love to see this.
Yes.
And this is supposedly the day that John sits down and starts talking to Douglas, Jack Douglas, the producer, about a tour.
Yes.
That he wants to tour, that we've got to think about what we're going to do with this band. Are we going to get this band together? What else do we need? Do we need a horn section? Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a big production tour.
A proper tour.
This is going to be a big production tour.
So also in August of 1980, Ringo's working on Stop and Smell the Roses, that album.
Yep.
George is working on Somewhere in England. But when he makes the first submission of Somewhere in England in September,
millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
For the first time, I think, of any Beatle ever, a record company says, no, that is not good enough.
Yes.
Although
I would say maybe the first time that
happened... Maybe it's the record company's fault, obviously.
No, well, what I would say the first time that probably happened was Red Rose Speedway.
Okay, true. That did go through the filter. Yes, okay. But...
Okay. I win. So
what you're saying is Paul is the trailblazer.
Paul is the trailblazer for delivering subpar records. Absolutely. So anyway, Warner Brothers hear this first pass and they say, no, this is not what we want at all.
Yep.
It's too downbeat. It's too laid back. We need something a little bit more up tempo, and this is embarrassing. This is a terrible kind of knockback for Harrison. This is a Beatle having his album rejected.
Yes,
so he literally has to go away and record 4 new tracks. So again, this is not a good time for George.
No, and so the other thing that happens in September is that John starts to publicly reemerge. So he still hasn't finished recording the Double Fantasy album with Yoko. But he is starting to do interviews and publicity, and he still hasn't nailed down the record contract that's going to be releasing the Double Fantasy album. But he does one of these very long, extended 10-day Playboy interviews, which doesn't get published until January 1981, where he, you know, looks at Beatles songs track by track and...
Yeah.
You know, it's the type of these type of interviews were a real thing in the 70s, where they go on for days.
Yes, for days and days and days.
We don't really see that anymore.
This takes place, as you say, over 10 days. There's a variety of locations. He has promised Playboy that this will be an exclusive.
But he's doing a big interview with Rolling Stone at the same time, isn't he?
And with Newsweek.
Oh right, okay.
So what happens is the Newsweek interview comes out. And Playboy, David Sheff, is the interviewer, get on the phone to him and say, this is absolutely terrible. What have you done? You know, we're trailing this as our exclusive thing. And John says, oh, I'm really, really sorry. What can I do to make it up to you? And Sheff says, tell you what, let's extend the interview and sit down and go through every Beatles song track by track.
Oh.
So the only reason that we have that
yes.
is because Lennon kind of messed up the exclusive arrangement with Playboy.
Right.
And threw this in as the compensation.
And this is the interview where he says, yes, Paul helped co-write In My
yes.
Life. And,
yes.
oh, I hate this song.
Yeah. This is. I think this is where he says about, you know, I wrote, do you want to know a secret for George? It's only got three notes. He's not the best singer in the
yes,
world. And
yes.
you think, well, there's another little kind of slight because of the book
yeah.
and the George relationship. Obviously, there are questions about, will the Beatles get back together again? And
yeah.
Lennon is very dismissive of this and saying, well, why should we? It's just an illusion and people are trying to recapture something. You know, it's not going to happen.
And at the end of the month, the date is the 22nd of September, he signs with David Geffen on the Geffen Records label to release
yes.
the still unfinished Double Fantasy
yeah.
album. And there obviously was a lot of people who would have been very excited about a John Lennon album on their label. And the story goes that Geffen was the only person who understood that it was a John and Yoko album.
Yes, I think that was the big thing. And this is a recurring theme with John. The reason why, you know, Klein made the big impression back in the day was he was talking about Yoko and he, you know, talked about her art and all the rest of it. So Geffen realizes, learns from this, and he mm-hmm. says, right, no, not a problem. Absolutely not a problem.
Yeah.
Now, I think he has said subsequently, you know, he would obviously have much preferred this to be a John Lennon album, but it is what it is. And he, I think without hearing it.
Yes.
He
yeah,
said,
he
yeah,
didn't
yeah,
hear
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We now, again, the speed mm-hmm. of this. So this is in September, and last day of July is when they rang the producer.
I know, it's so
fast. So it's
fast.
Staggering.
Yeah.
But I suppose when you're John Lennon...
Well, they're getting back to that Beatle pace, you know?
Yeah.
It's recorded,
yeah,
let's
yeah.
get it out. There's two other interesting things for September. Obviously, the release of Temporary Secretary by Paul McCartney is the third single from McCartney 2. Again, I think...
Again, huge.
It was blasting from the airwaves.
World event, yeah.
It didn't hit the top 10 this time round, but as I said, it's had a bit of an afterlife. It was released as this limited edition 25,000 copy 12-inch, which is where we got Secret Friend on the B-side, which is...
Is 25,000 a limited edition?
Well, at a time when singles would sell that in a day,
suppose,
it obviously would
I
do.
Suppose.
I don't know if you own a copy of the single. It's quite funny. It has
yeah.
this cartoon on the front.
I've seen, yeah.
And there's all these kind of smudges of paint, and you read the credits on the back, and it's like additional artwork, i.e. smudges of paint by Paul McCartney, which I always find amusing. But there's another thing at the end of September which isn't really verified, and we
no.
haven't had it verified yet, which
is this where John has a haircut.
Well, John has a haircut, which is, seems to be a recurring thing.
It is
happens.
A recurring thing.
He gets
theme.
Lots of haircuts towards the end
yeah.
of 1980, trying to figure out what way he wants to look.
Yeah. So,
but there's a story in, is it the which book is it?
It's Keith Badman's book, which is The Beatles After the Breakup, and
yeah.
he kind of goes through day by day, sort of basically from 1970 on. But yeah, you've mentioned that the Playboy interview is going on.
Yeah.
So the final session for that is on the 28th of September. And Keith Badman says that he did that interview in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Then he has a haircut.
Haircut.
And then he and Yoko get on a plane and fly to LA to see Monty Python at the Hollywood Bowl.
Yes.
Where they meet George, Olivia and Derek Taylor.
Hmm.
George gives John a copy of Somewhere in England, which would have been
unreleased.
Rejected,
yeah.
you know, the rejected version.
Yeah.
They watch the show and then John and Yoko fly back to New York that night.
So we don't know, is this a real thing? Because it's never been reported
it's
anywhere
never,
else.
No, it's never been reported.
And it's kind of a big deal.
It is kind of a big deal.
George did say after the fact, oh, I didn't see John
yeah,
for years
and,
before
and,
he died.
And Graham Thompson, again, in that book, the bio of George, says that John and George had not spoken for 2 years prior to December 1980. So he doesn't give this any credence. And there's a lot of speculation about that. Badman doesn't give a source for this.
Yes.
So short of, you know, Olivia confirming it or one of the Pythons or someone who was there, but
yeah.
it seems unlikely to me,
it feels unlikely.
I would like to think that it was
yeah,
true.
Yeah, my wish
seems,
is that it is real.
It seems unlikely.
So then we, obviously, after September comes October.
And on the 1st of October,
yes,
John has another haircut.
He does have another haircut. And on the 9th of October, John Lennon turns 40 and Sean Lennon turns 5 because they share the same birthday.
Can we talk about Sean's birthday present?
Yeah, what did he got? Some toys?
Some toys, maybe a birthday cake. But in September, John and Yoko had bought him a plane.
Right.
For his fifth birthday.
A toy plane?
No, a real plane.
I see.
£62,000.
Right.
In old money.
Yeah.
And it came complete with a pilot and a stewardess.
Well, he's too young to fly it himself, Stephen.
Well, I
suppose that's ridiculous.
That's true.
Yes.
That's true.
They had a big party.
But imagine no possessions.
Imagine that. Imagine no airplanes. They had a party at Inn on the Green, I think, which is a big fancy restaurant in Central Park. And a few years ago, I know nothing is private anymore, a video camera footage of that party
from
1980 circulated on the internet, which is kind of crazy. What does happen in October is that they finalise the recording sessions for Double Fantasy. And the last session is dated as being, I think, on the 19th of October, is that right?
Yep, that's right.
And on the 20th of October, the following day, released to the world is the first fruits of these sessions, which is the single Just Like Starting Over on the A side, and on the flip side is Yoko's Kiss, Kiss, Kiss.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great twofer. I personally love Just Like Starting Over.
Yeah.
I think it's a I think it's a great song. I know it's kind of got a bit of retro.
When did you first hear the song? Or
I first heard the song, it would have been in 1988 when I went to see and subsequently bought the soundtrack for the Imagine documentary.
Okay.
And so that's a great CD. We mentioned it briefly on the compilations episode. It's got some Beatles songs up front. It's got a really good Lennon solo compilation at the back end. And, Just Like Starting Over is there. And I just, you know me, Stephen, I like the old pop edge of things, you know.
Yeah.
So to hear John Lennon doing kind of music with a pop edge,
well,
I enjoy that.
There are a couple of interesting things about the single. So one, it starts with that little bell,
yes,
which is clearly a direct reference to
the heavy bell at Mother.
So it's kind of like 10 years on.
And he said that explicitly, that bell is there to show his state of mind compared to the earlier bell.
And he clearly has a kind of Roy Orbison Buddy Holly.
Doesn't he say that on the raw version?
This is for Buddy.
And Eddie.
Yeah. So he's clearly, this is a throwback single. I have a very clear memory of that single coming out. I have a very clear memory of the anticipation.
Yes.
And the disappointment.
Yeah.
And it was very badly received, certainly in the UK. It was considered to be sort of very anemic, a little bit kind of
naff.
Yeah. He was, dare I say, intruding on McCartney's territory, that kind of domesticity, the silly love song thing, plus the whole production style. Even then, I think it was slightly dated, or it didn't have any raw edge. And I think people were expecting Lennon to come back with a kind of raw edge. Now, maybe that was unrealistic, because you think that this previous studio album was Walls and Bridges, which is just a studio slick production.
I do think, Lennon is thinking, I want to be in the, as we mentioned earlier on, Billy Joel's Glass Houses, Empty Glass by Pete Townsend, this sort of grown-up 60s pop rock contemporary thing. And he wanted to get into that space, really.
And I think certainly a couple of the sort of people that wrote books that sort of were hanging out with him around that time said he was worried that the whole sort of domestic feel to the songs was not going to be well received. But he was, he was desperate for a sort of big hit and chart success. And it's, as you say, it's a pop song.
Yeah.
And I suppose the thing is, Lennon's had really made his reputation not in pop since the Beatles. It was rock.
It
was a kind of harder edge thing.
Meaning something.
Yeah, it meant, he was, it causes and...
But I don't think there's any other song that he could have put out or put at the start of his album, because it's saying, we're starting over.
I think it was clearly written
with that in mind.
With that in mind. For me,
The
much more interesting song is the Yoko B-side.
Well, Yoko... we'll talk a bit more about Double Fantasy in a second, but I mean, Yoko is kind of working on a more cutting edge, kind of new wavy type sound for that album. But what's interesting is what else is happening in October when they're finishing that album is that Wings have recording sessions in October. So Wings are still a concern.
They're still going.
The wheels have fallen off the touring wagon. You know, whatever Denny Lane, who released a single called Japanese Tears that summer about Paul's situation at the start of the year, whatever bad vibes that caused, Paul still hasn't knocked the nail on the head for Wings. Wings, technically, if I'm right, doesn't stop as a salaried institution till towards the end of 1981, when he eventually tells Holly and Juber,
"It's over,
we're done." But so Wings are recording for a thing called Cold Cuts, which is Hot Hits and Cold Cuts, which is the never-ending, never-released.
Tinkering.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which was supposed to be halfway between a hits album and an unreleased album. And, you know,
And this was Wingspan. Would that maybe get close to it? Not really.
There's a song called Water Spout that was supposed to come out in All the Best in 87.
Hey Diddle.
Yeah, Hey Diddle. And they're working on tracks like there's a version of Night Out with lyrics that's done for Cold Cuts at this time. So, but Wings are still working. They do about 3 weeks of sessions in October 1980. EMI release another Beatles compilation called Beatle Ballads. You know, there's an auction at Abbey Road, and all of these auctions where they're selling stuff.
That, again, that's a very interesting thing to me, is that EMI are having a kind of garage sale.
Yeah.
So they're selling bits and pieces, so including the four-track machines that Sgt. Pepper was recorded on.
Yeah.
And Mike Oldfield pays £1,000 for the Magical Mystery.
I know, the Mellotron.
Mellotron, which has the original tapes and settings. Man. But you think, why would EMI be thinking of selling these things? Or why was McCartney not buying them up?
But sure, when we were at that EMI Abbey Road visit, what was interesting is this notion at that time they were going to rebuild it, knock it down.
Yeah.
You know, the value hadn't totally landed with people.
No,
the value
so they're still desperately milking the catalogue with Beatles ballads, but they haven't quite figured out that, you know, like they, I think this is the auction that includes an ashtray that Ringo used. I mean, you know, this nonsensical, they clearly have no real idea of what they have.
And John demos two songs in October. One is Serve Yourself, which, if anyone hasn't heard it, is hilarious.
It's a great song. It's very funny.
Kind of a takeoff on Bob Dylan, who was in the middle of his Christian phase at that time.
Gotta serve somebody.
Yeah.
Lennon took that Christian conversion very badly.
What else did he say about it?
Well, he just there are several versions of that Serve Yourself. And he just railed against the notion that Dylan, this kind of spokesman for a generation, would suddenly become
submit himself
to this kind of Christian thing. But interestingly, in at least one version of that, he starts then at the end of the song saying, you know, you've got to serve your mother. You've got to serve your mother. And you think, is that kind of his very self-knowledge? He's, you know, this whole relationship with his mother and that kind of pop psychology. So it's an interesting interesting take, but that's worth checking out.
And the other song he demos is Real Love, which goes on to this afterlife as being
a Beatles song.
A Beatles song. So then we move into November, and George starts re-recording his rejected the rejected songs for the rejected version of Somewhere in England. And he also, the second handmade film, The Long Good Friday, appears. Now, this isn't a film they've made from scratch. It's a film they've bought over the distribution. The film is made, they've bought the distribution rights, and they showed at the film festival in London in November 1980. But it shows that handmade films is up and running and that this is, you know, another thing that George is putting his name to. There's another couple of re-releases then in November.
Yeah, this is EMI, the Music for Pleasure.
Yeah,
they release three or four albums for $1.99 each, and that includes Ringo, Mind Games, and Dark Horse. Nothing from Paul. So Paul's obviously selling well enough
that he doesn't
need to be discounted.
Bumped down.
They also put out the rock and roll music compilation as two separate volumes.
Right.
And interestingly, I think we mentioned this on the podcast at the time, we talked about compilations, they use different mixes for this. So if you bought the UK rock and roll music album, you got the original recordings from the 60s and the mixes from the 60s. These are the specific mixes that Martin had done for the US rock and roll compilation, now appear for the first time. And then in November, the final sort of big compilation is that mail order Beatles box.
Yes, that's
which is
thing.
A weird kind of 8 LPs, 126 tracks in a box that with EMI's mail order section put out. That's worth looking at because I'll not go through it here, but we've got different mixes and odd takes and the various rarities pop up there. So the only reason really to seek that out, I think it's available on LP and cassette, is these odd mixes.
And so on the 19th of November, Ringo is at George's place in Friar Park, in the Friar Park Studios.
Yes.
And so Ringo and George are together and they're recording a first version of a song called All Those Years Ago, which the initial intention is that George has written this and Ringo is going to sing it.
It's going to be a track on Ringo's next album.
Yes. So we've had Paul contributing to Ringo's album. George is contributing to Ringo's album on the 19th of November. And on the 26th of November, Ringo and Barbara go to New York and they have a 5-hour dinner and meet up and hang with John and Yoko.
Yeah, so Ringo said, you know, we were just going to meet for an hour or so, but we had such a great time. It just ran on and it was just fantastic. And this seems to genuinely have been a sort of, although it was organised, it kind of spontaneously became an entire evening of social activity. And John says, yes, he will play on Ringo's new LP. So we've already had Paul recording some stuff. George has recorded a track. And John is saying, yep, absolutely, I'm up for that. And here's a song that you might like. And this originally started as being called Strange Days Indeed, but it's Nobody Told Me.
Yeah.
So he gives that to Ringo and says, I think this would be great for you. And they set up a session date, which is the 14th of January, 1981.
They do indeed. And then in the, between all of that, in the middle of all that, finally you get the release of the Double Fantasy album, which comes out on the 17th of November, 1980. And the reviews of that are good and bad.
Yes, it's a very kind of mixed bag. Again, I remember from the time I didn't buy the record. I mean, I'd heard the single. I was really not that impressed. I didn't buy the single. And when the album came out, it really did not get good reviews, certainly in the UK.
Yeah.
And it was just seen as a little bit of a damp squib.
The other side note is on the 26th of November in New York is the cinema debut premiere of Rock Show, which is the movie interpretation.
It's all about the Wings.
Of Wings as 1976 Wings Over America tour. Paul did not attend. He was back in the UK. He was in the studio messing around with George Martin, starting to figure out what his next album or next recording would be. So then we move into December.
Well, just before we leave November, can I say 28th of November is an interesting day?
Yes, yes, yes.
So this is the ongoing lawsuits about the Beatlemania stage show. And
so Beatlemania is a strange thing. It's one of these, and we should look at all these things some days. It was a late 70s stage show which tried to tell the Beatles stories through a mock Beatles band telling their songs against news footage and all the rest. And it turned into a movie at one point as well. But it was called Beatlemania and it was trading on their name and songs.
And so the Beatles are trying to have this stopped.
Yes.
Basically for sort of copyright or what have you. And The legal argument for Beatlemania was really, well, this is all fair game and the Beatles don't exist anymore, and you know, we should be allowed to carry on. Now, John gives a formal deposition. So in America, the format is you sit in front of, you're questioned, and all of this goes down as a sworn statement, this deposition. And in this, he states the Beatles have plans to reform for a reunion tour. And a lot is made of this, that, you know, this was a genuine thing that the Beatles were going to. The lawsuit was eventually settled in 1986, and that's when the deposition became public knowledge. And this was sort of seized upon as the possible reunion in 1980-81. My own view is this is for the purposes of the lawsuit. And
it's John leaving the option open
at
best,
yes,
and saying if anyone has the right to decide this, it's the four of us, and I'm going to.
But I don't think we should. Yeah, we can't read too much into that. I don't think.
So then we get into the first week of December. On the 5th of December, John calls home. He to his aunt Mimi. He has a big chat with her and says, you know, he's looking forward to hopefully coming to England in the new year. He also gives a huge interview that day, going on for about 9 hours, for Rolling Stone magazine, which doesn't fully come out until 2010. It's a good read, that interview.
It is.
And but the plan was that John was due to be the cover star of the first copy of Rolling Stone that was due to hit the newsstands in 1981, and this was all part of the ongoing publicity drive, because whatever people thought about Double Fantasy and the album and the singles, John was back in talking to the newspapers. He gave good copy, he was a good interviewee.
Exactly. I think this is it, the PR machine was in overdrive, because they already had songs, you know, they'd got the Double Fantasy songs out, they had songs in the can to work on for the next album, they were already looking at the next album. They were already talking to Jack Douglas about a tour. So regardless of the slightly mixed reviews, it was onwards and upwards. And as part of that, Andy Peebles from Radio 1 flies over from London, and he secures an interview across the 6th and the 7th of December. That's an interview that has been released in various formats. I think there's little snippets of it up on YouTube, but certainly there is a double CD
of that interview.
Yes, I have to say it's not. I would much prefer reading the Playboy interview or the Rolling Stone interview. Andy Peebles just simply takes him through in a rather dull fashion, chronologically, through the Beatles years and his solo years.
And that was across the weekend.
Yeah.
The 8th of December was a Monday.
And that's John gets a haircut.
John starts the day by getting a haircut on the 8th of December. And after that, it's in a 50s kind of retro style haircut.
Yeah.
After that, he goes back to the Dakota for the Annie Leibovitz photo shoot for the promised cover of Rolling Stone.
So if you look at the cover of the John Lennon collection, LP, that's the 50s kind of quiff.
Right.
And he has a sort of a leather jacket with a kind of collar. And so he's kind of clearly going back to that Hamburg vibe, that early 60s vibe.
And the photo shoot includes photos that have gone on to become quite famous of John and Yoko in various stages of undress. John and Yoko both naked, Yoko fully clothed, and John with Yoko as well. But they and it's also been filmed, so there's film of this
so
as well.
It's incorporated, I think, into a video.
Yeah.
And John actually suggests before the photo shoot ends that a particular photograph, which is Yoko fully clothed, lying on the floor with John kind of naked but kind of wrapped around her, that's the cover shot.
Yeah.
So this is going to be an early 1980 edition of Rolling Stone.
So after a full day like that, they are still in the recording studio mode, and they are still working on making records. So early in the evening they leave the Dakota, and the plan is to go off and do some more recording.
Yes, so they're heading to the record plant, and there's a fan of a photographer, Paul Goresh, and he takes a photograph of John signing a copy of Double Fantasy for a fan. They get in the car and then they go to the record plant, and that night they're working on Walking on Thin Ice,
a Yoko
which
song.
Is a Yoko song, which I have to say, for me, just fantastic song. It's come out in various, it's been remixed to death, but the original version is just a sensational track. And they finish it that evening, and John hits the button and says to Yoko through the talkback, you've just recorded your first number one.
Echoes of George Martin back in 1962, at the end of 62, at the recording of Please Please Me.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that John and Yoko decide that that's a good enough day's work. Jack Douglas, once they leave, he wipes some
tapes. He wipes all of the tapes of that day's studio chat and studio banter. And he's never talked about what was on those tapes or what was said. So there's a sort of air of mystery hangs around what were they talking about, or why did he feel the need to delete that?
And then they decide to return home to the Dakota, and they return home on Monday, the 8th of December, at about 10:50 p.m. The following morning, Paul gets a phone call, and he is given the news. And he decides to proceed with his day as normal, that he's going to go to Air Studios, where he's been working with George Martin, the first extended bit of working with George Martin that he has done in a while, and figures there's nothing else he can do except work.
And George Harrison, the same. He gets a phone call in the middle of the night, goes back to sleep, gets up in the morning. He has a session scheduled for Dream Away at Fire Park, and he starts that session and then abandons that halfway through.
And Yoko records a piece of music that day.
She records a piano demo that morning of a song called I Don't Know Why, which would subsequently end up on Season of Glass, which was her first post-Double Fantasy album, which was produced by Phil Spector.
And as the day progresses, Paul, who is working that day with very famous Irish musician Paddy Maloney, realises that he's not going to get anything done. and the sessions kind of end with the musicians for the day sitting around and having a drink and talking and a chat. And in the interim, Ringo and Barbara decide to fly to New York.
They have been holidaying in the Caribbean and they fly to the Dakota.
And spend time with Yoko.
Yeah.
And then we get to the end of 1980 and back at number one in the charts is Just Like Starting Over.
Yeah, it gets to number one in the US on the 27th of December and at number one in the UK on the 3rd of January 1981.
And so by the time you get to the 1st of January 1981, the world is a very different place. And the world of the Beatles is a very different place. And what it means to be a fan of the Beatles becomes a very different thing. And any possibilities or dreams that had been so prevalent in the previous 10 yeah. years disappeared.
Yes.
And it only gets kind of harder to think about when we kind of look at that year in detail and saw how vital and busy and excited all of these four people were.
I think so. I think that's what you take away from it. That 1980, everyone was working. Everyone was focused on what they were doing, but also at the end of the year, you had this idea that they were all going to appear on Ringo's next album.
Yes.
And that would have been the first time, I think, since 1973 when they all appeared on the same, not necessarily working together, but all on that same album. Ringo, his usual role of being the mediator there.
So that's 1980 in the world of the Beatles, and hopefully you'll see what we mean when we say that it is the year that changed everything in terms of their history. We hope you will contribute to the conversation. You can talk to us on our Facebook group, look up the Nothing Is Real Facebook group and ask to join. We're on Twitter on @BeatlesPod, and so you can tap us on the shoulder there and leave us a message and talk to us about this. We will put up a 1980s playlist.
Yep.
And you can hear what everybody was up to at that point in time. And wherever you download us, make sure you subscribe on that platform and leave some feedback for us going forward. But for now, this is Nothing Is Real. My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we'll see you the next time. Thanks.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.